tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. So we've been practicing together for 48 hours, is it? Two days? So today I've been emphasizing themes around impermanence and suggesting the way of using the perception of impermanence as a way of centering, focusing, stilling the mind. And perceptions are things that are a part of the way we interpret life. So as I was saying earlier, you can, if you taste salted butter, you can taste the salt in it, you can taste the oil in it, you can feel the oil in it. So we have this capacity to perceive things. And then the suggestion today and yesterday is to perceive the very feeling of change, how things change. What that requires is a very diligent sense of presence, because you can't notice change if you're talking about yesterday, thinking about tomorrow, or resisting the way things are, or criticizing the way things are, or whatever. So it requires a really strong sense of presence, a strong sense of awareness. And what I'm encouraging is a kind of receptive quality to your attention. If and we were chanting the Dhammacakka Sutta, or reciting it, and that sutta indicates that desire, the desire for pleasure and the desire to get rid of displeasure, is an involvement with sense experience, which keeps the mind dissatisfied, because you can never really settle on anything. You get some pleasure and that skirts away, slips through your fingers. So desire itself is a function in nature. It's necessary. So on Friday, Marion will be covered in blankets. We won't even see her. Fur coats. So desire is necessary. You need to stay warm as you can, and so on and so forth. But desire does not, the sense desire. So when we talk about desire in English, the word desire is used in a broad way. So some desires are skillful and some desires are unskillful. In Nepali, when we talk about the Four Noble Truths, the particular desire we refer to is called tanha, and craving. And it always has a connotation of being unskillful if misunderstood. So the pursuit of tanha is the pursuit of, it's the involvement in things of the mind and body in a way which keep the mind very, very restless and dissatisfied. So wanting something is not bad, but thinking that getting what you want will lead to peace is something the Buddha's trying to point out. It leads to certain pleasure, but what really leads to peace is a capacity to be aware of change. And this is especially true, like when you're freezing to death in a retreat. This is a crucial part of the teaching if you're going to survive tonight. So there is the use of desire, so I hope no one gets a flu and sues us here. So what we try to do in observing stream of consciousness is observe the very nature of frustration, of disappointment, so on. And well, we do our best to make this as comfortable as possible. So we have a plan to build a meditation hall. And if you've got $5 million, come and see me after. But for right now, this is what it is. We're trying to create a retreat that can accommodate more people than our little shrine room, so it's a generous offer, and there's some discomfort in it. Fortunately, I have a body that generates heat quite easily, so I'm pretty comfortable. Other people that I could speak about, they don't have a good heat generator, so it's more difficult for them. So I can make jokes, and that's maybe cruel or whatever, but there it is. You have what you have. You have the equipment you have, and you're trying to be with the equipment you have, be with the karma you have, in a way where you can find peace within that, and within a body which suffers pain and displeasure, within emotional system which feels things and reacts to things, and memory system that holds information and spews it out when you don't want it, or doesn't spew it out when you want it. Yeah, that's how memory works. It's sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. And this movement, this kind of mind-body experience that we're in, is nature. It's just in the nature of the body to feel cold, to feel discomfort, to feel pain, to feel pleasure, to enjoy the warmth of the shrine room in the morning. And it's in the nature of our emotional system to feel hurt when people insult us. Sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. Not true, right? How many times have we all been insulted or cruelly spoken to? It hurts. It hurts. We have hearts. We have emotions. And that's part of being, you know, part of our human incarnation, that we are sensitive beings. Our bodies are sensitive. We have retentive memories and so on and so forth. And the part of our life is to try to find, to try to live skillfully, to try to live a moral life, try to live a generous life where we're not hurting anyone, we're not hurting ourselves, doing the maximum good that we can. And that's very profitable. That creates very good results. Creates a good sense of self-respect, a sense of respect in society. So that's the social norm, and what we call the social dharma. And for the bhikkhus, it's called the Vinaya. For the lay people, it's the precepts and generosity and social responsibility. On a retreat, we don't have to organize that part of our lives. That part of our lives is set up by the routines of the monastery. So we have the kind of freedom to watch stream of consciousness. And a stream of consciousness, whatever happens, is nature. And is there anything that comes up in your mind or your emotional body that's not natural? I can't think. It's all natural, right? So if you have a really angry impulse, that's not unnatural. It's natural. If you feel kind of really excited by something, that's natural. If you feel bored, that's natural. If you like, if you dislike. So this, is there anything else in our experience which is not natural? It's all natural. Might not be pleasant, and you might not want to tell everyone what your mind is doing. Sometimes you just like to keep it a secret, but it's still natural. Even if you have really horrible thoughts or beautiful beatific thoughts, it's all natural. And so we say it's all Dhamma. It's all in the nature of things. And so when we are looking at stream of consciousness, on the level of action and speech, we try to refrain from doing harm, and we try to do the maximum good. Okay, so that's how we relate on this retreat. We try to fulfill the little duties that we have. And so there's the act of restraint, of not hurting others with language which is cruel or not distracting, whatever. In terms of what the mind produces, it's all okay. There's nothing wrong with anything that the mind brings up. So the task is not to have a mind which never produces anything. It's a mind which sees these productions as changing phenomena nature. So one of the really teachings which I've taken to with Lompo Sumedho these last few years is his beautiful phrase, "It all belongs." Now that you can only use in terms of stream of consciousness. If you use that in the other realm, the social realm, "It all belongs," then in some kind of justification of cruelty and killing and robbing and so on, then that would be a misuse of that term. But "it all belongs" in terms of stream of consciousness, to me, that's that beautiful acceptance of the good, the bad, and the ugly, whatever. It all belongs. And then the choice I make is things are produced in consciousness, as things arise in consciousness, these choices that I make, this is what we mean by karma. And then the resultant karma is accumulated, the result of accumulated choices. So if I have cruel impulses, I say it all belongs. Yeah, that's acceptance. But then I follow those cruel impulses. I think those cruel impulses. I keep perpetuating those cruel impulses. It all belongs. But I now face the karmic result of the consequences of being heedless. So in one hand, I say cruel impulses are okay, they're natural, but the pursuit, attachment, indulgence in cruel impulses leads to a negative result. And that's the resultant karma, the accumulated consequences of my intentions. This is the way you can think about karma, the accumulated consequences of my intentions. Karma, quite often, resultant karma is, like in English, karma is quite often used as fatalism. So it's my karma to be myopic or whatever, right? So some kind of crime and punishment kind of mindset. But you can't really reflect on that. You can't kind of reflect on it in this life. But you can reflect on the accumulated consequences of each intention. Right? And this is the resultant. So the results we have now in our practice and in our life and so on is the to some extent the accumulated consequences of what we thought and did. And you can see that, you can notice that. So acceptance of the way things are is the beginning of awareness. But then having enough presence of mind, having enough discernment in what's going on, then we make choices. We make choices of how we think or how we meditate. And these choices, if they come from wisdom, will give wise results. If they come from compassion, they give compassion results. But if we're unaware and we're inattentive, then we make, the results come from heedlessness and the habits of foolishness and inadvertence, they accumulate and we get all confused and suffer. So it's obviously very, very important to awaken to the way things are, but not as a judgment. So why I like the emphasis on it all belongs is quite often we, because we're insincere people, and we sit in this freezing tent with the good intention of practicing Dhamma and listening to Dhamma, we have very good hearts. We have very, very good karma in the sense that the accumulated consequences of our lives have led us to this sense of doing good work, of living a moral life, of enduring painful knees and cold and so on to understand the Dhamma. These are the accumulated consequences of a very good life, right? And so that's to be praised. This is to be praised. But one of the things about us is that usually we are because we tend to have very good intentions, we sometimes feel terribly overly critical of the negativity that arises in our minds. So we establish viewpoints, egotistical viewpoints, that we should not feel certain things and that we should only feel other kinds of things. But that would be a misunderstanding of the practice. If I say to myself I shouldn't feel something, then when it comes up, what do? I judge myself as being guilty. And that's not necessary. That's not the practice of it all belongs. If I say it all belongs and then just indulge in selfish, narcissistic kinds of tendencies and hurt people and do a kind of Frank Sinatra, do it my way lifestyle, that would be an indulgence. So what is the middle way? The middle way is to awaken to the way things are, choose moral, make moral choices, make choices towards generosity, and begin to try to discover what is the spiritual reality that the Buddha was pointing to. What is the spiritual possibility that the Buddha was pointing to? And this, we need to use this word spiritual now, I think, in our culture. We can't use religious. Transcendent, people don't like that word, I found. If I use that, I get criticized. So now I use spiritual. But there is something that the Buddha realized, and sometimes we touch that. We touch this deep peace of the mind or the deep compassion of the heart. We realize there is this this sort of dimension in life which is not just caught up with our emotions and our thoughts. There's a deep possibility. And the realization of that possibility is something I think we all hunger for. I think most of us have experienced something like that. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be here. Sometimes we read about it or whatever. So that possibility is realized, as I've been saying, through a different kind of a desire. It's not the desire to get pleasure and dismiss pain. It's the desire to understand suffering. And that is a very mature kind of desire, I think, to understand suffering rather than to blame it or run away from it. And so the Four Noble Truths is pointing to this sense of making conscious suffering, making conscious discontent, letting discontent come up into consciousness. It all belongs. And on this retreat, I've been encouraging, like with body awareness, the meditation I've been describing, I say to you, notice the feelings in your legs. Make that conscious. Notice your spinal column. Make that conscious. Let the body become conscious of bodily sensation. And that word, make it conscious, is very important for me, because that's a way of admitting into the present moment these bodily feelings. They're always there. The body's always functioning. Usually we only notice the body in its extreme pleasure or pain. So now we're just taking the very, very ordinary, and we're training in attending to the ordinary feelings in the body, feelings of hot or cold, very ordinary things, and we're making it conscious. We're letting it come up into consciousness. And that's the secret of the First Noble Truth. The First Noble Truth is that suffering has to be understood, discontent has to be understood, and that standing under or understanding is making things conscious. Now, when we suffer, when we are disappointed, when we are annoyed at something, or when we're frustrated, or when we're, you know, our minds are scattered, or so on and so forth, we don't want to make that conscious. We want to get rid of it, usually. So we either blame or distract. But that is not the way of the desire to understand suffering. That's the desire to get rid of it. And getting rid of it, if you just try to get rid of it through ignorance, through not understanding, you'll not get a good result. You might get a good distraction for a while, but the same patterns will come up again. So the desire to understand. What is it really like to feel disappointed? What is it really feel? What does it feel like to feel oppressed by someone? Well, what does it feel like to feel like I'm not getting anywhere in life? Whatever it is, whatever mode of suffering comes up. And making that conscious is like recognizing the mood of the mind. Recognizing that the mind has this particular kind of tone or quality to it right now. So that, what happens when you say, you take body awareness? What happens when you, when I ask you, say, to notice the spine, the base of the spine? What happens? At first, there's maybe, unless you have like spinal problems and you have back problems, you don't really notice much. And then if you just wait with it, you begin to feel vibration, pressure, tension, temperature, right? And that waiting quality where you allow things to become conscious is very, I think, very important in the First Noble Truth. To understand suffering, you have to give it a chance to become conscious. Like I can know I feel irritated by someone or anxious about something, but to actually stop and say to myself, well, to make conscious the feeling of suffering and maybe anxiety, say, what's it really like? That's the First Noble Truth, understanding suffering, standing under it. And that is a big step in humanity, big step, because most of the time we either, you know, humanity chooses blame or distraction, compensations or whatever. When we do that, when we have the presence of mind to make conscious the way things are, and we begin to notice things like disappointment or sense of lack of self-worth or shame or guilt or all these difficult things we face, we begin to see them as dharma. We begin to see them as objects of mind, as natural phenomena. And as we see them as natural phenomena, we also begin to see the desire not to have or the desire to have, the desire to get rid of or desire to get something else. And that very desire, in this case it's called tanha, craving, is really the heart of the problem, because as long as we don't see tanha, craving, we pursue things to try to satisfy that craving. So if I feel disappointed, say, I feel disappointed with someone, I have a confrontation with them, you disappointed me, you made me suffer. Yeah, maybe. And then someone else does it to me, I say, you made me suffer, we need a meeting, we need to talk about this. And at some functional level, sure, if you're the boss, and you have someone who's not fulfilling their duties, and they don't, so you have to call them on it, fire them, or speak to them. Sure, that's at a function level. But disappointment itself is a natural phenomenon. And when I can just be fully conscious of the feeling, this is just an example of disappointment, that takes a lot of mindfulness. That takes a lot of mindfulness. Because usually the mind just jumps into criticism. I feel disappointed, and then someone go to the Ajahn and tell him. This happens to me a lot. There's a problem, go and complain to someone, right? This is the best way to get rid of disappointment. But to actually look at disappointment, oh, I do it too. I feel disappointed, I complain to them. They complain to me, or whatever. We don't complain that much. But just to like feel disappointment and wait with it, that's very uncomfortable. It's unpleasant because I like to be fulfilled and all kinds of levels. And so the unpleasant feeling of disappointment drives me to criticize others, criticize myself, find distractions, eat something, anything but be fully conscious of this feeling of disappointment. But what happens if I sustain full consciousness of disappointment? If I just stay with it, then I'll also stay with the desire to get rid of it. That's the discomfort part. I stay with it, and its nature is to change. Its nature is to cease. And that's why I've been emphasizing the perception of change. So then I look at disappointment and I say, it's uncertain. Now I have objective sense of it. I'm no longer the subject in the storyline of disappointment. Oh, they should have done this, and I shouldn't have done that, and I shouldn't have done this, and they should have done that. No, now I'm actually feeling the disappointment as an object, as a mood of the mind, and it stays for a while, fully conscious, and in its cessation, I have a peace of mind now that is free from desire. And this is the entry into Nibbana. This is the entry into the spiritual part of our life. Because when desire ceases for objects, then I have a freedom within all objects, within all experiences, within all emotions. I begin to taste the silence of the mind, which is not dependent. The mind which is always running away from disappointments and blaming disappointments or distracting, that mind always needs an object to pacify it, to make it happy. And that's not peace, that's restlessness. So this isn't a question of morality anymore, is it? It's not immoral to feel disappointed and then to do something, but it's a deeper question of spiritual realization. So think about like your own moods of the mind, your own moods, and then observe where the moods go into thoughts and storylines and narratives, and see if you, before it goes into narratives, or as you see it going into narratives, see if you can just make conscious the underlying tone of the mind. And when you do that, quite often the mind stops. You ask a question, what's the mood of the mind? The mind stops. And you go, oh, I don't know what he's talking about. But if you wait, if you just wait a bit, just wait. You know, like I say, with body consciousness, just wait. You'll see that within maybe a minute or 30 seconds, if the mind's, let's say if the mind's in a critical mode, really critical, something will pop up, some sense experience, and the mind will be critical towards that. And you say, oh, I see what's happening. There's this mood. Now, the mood's not a, a constant thing, like a clock. You know, the mood might have phases. It comes in like sine curve, coming in, coming out, coming in. So you have to wait. But you have an intuition. I'm really critical today. So you get under the criticism. You make conscious. What is? Okay, that's critical. Well, you have enough discernment to know it's critical. What's it like? What's criticism like? And you wait. I don't know. Us and mind silent because you're attentive. You're not caught in the thoughts. You're attentive, and then you notice the arising. Ah, now you notice the arising of critical faculty, judging someone as being inadequate or whatever, not right. Shouldn't be this way. Now you're really mindful. Now you're mindful. And now you see, no, it has a nature to arise. And then you see, you watch it change now. You don't indulge in the thoughts. It goes back into the silence of the mind. Now you're beginning to see that that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. And that which knows arising and ceasing, what's that? That's the freedom of the mind. That's the peace of the mind. So in the contemplation of impermanence, you begin to notice arising and ceasing. Quite often you notice ceasing first. You note it like, so what's encouraged in the texts and so on is to notice non-anger, to notice the mind which is not angry. That we don't usually notice that. You know, we just say, well, I'm angry again, oh gosh. But actually, much time you're not angry. So notice non-anger, or non-complaining, or non-fear, or non-greed. Now these don't seem like much, but it is true, isn't it? That right now, maybe you don't feel any anger. Hope not. Let's see, don't feel any anger. What does non-anger feel like? You're making that conscious. And if you make that conscious, what happens is you tend to notice the arising of anger more. And if you tend to notice the arising of anger, you'll tend to notice the cessation. And so that kind of reflection on change begins to bring you home to the place in your heart which is peaceful, irrespective of the anger. So anger belongs. It all belongs. It comes and it goes according to causes and conditions. It's neither right nor wrong. It arises and ceases. And you begin to be that beautiful mind which just knows change. So I would suggest then, like right now, I notice a bit of discomfort with the cold going on in the room. Now this will change. It will change, right? At some point in your life, you will be warm. I guarantee it. And watch that, right? Like observe that. Just like, because like let's say today, this afternoon, when we heard the digger, it was very loud, wasn't it? Did anyone notice when it stopped? Or did you know, was the mind just thinking about something and then when did it stop? When did it cease? So like when you have suffering, like if you're feeling cold and I keep running this talk on to torture you and so on, right? He's doing it on purpose. You know, then your mind starts to think, God, shut up, will you? I want to get home. I want a hot water bottle. And so the mind reacts to the cold, right? And then when you get your hot water bottle and you're comfortable, you won't even notice it's not cold anymore. You'll be thinking about the next thing. You'll be anticipating the next thing. You know, the next comfort or the next discomfort. And so the mind just moves from one comfort to one discomfort, one comfort. But to actually just be with, like, discomfort feels this way now and notice it's changing nature, that's the challenge of constant awareness, right? Just the constant awareness. So you take on, you know, you really do take on the unpleasant, not as a self-mortification practice to hurt yourself, but rather to develop the parami, to develop the character which can be with the pleasant or the unpleasant, pleasant or the unpleasant. And as you do that, your reference point is no longer pleasant or unpleasant, it's the knowing of change. And as your reference point becomes that, your home ground, you see, that's your home ground, your default mechanism is freedom. Whereas before we started to practice, the default mechanism is suffering because we're always seeking ourselves in objects, seeking gratification in objects, and it is a losing game. It doesn't liberate you. Now you'll probably think me a complete fool when you get into your nice warm bed, and you'll have your nice duvet on, and you'll be all nice and cozy and suffer, and there'll be no suffering. Huh? I wonder. Now, I would ask you as a practice, when you get into your nice, comfort, warm duvet, now you'll feel incredible relief. Now, what is more pleasant on a retreat than feeling cold, your knees are killing, your back's killing, your mind's killing you, and you lay down? That's just ultimate bliss, isn't it? It is. It's just so pleasant. How long will it last? You might fall asleep, right? But I suggest you watch how long before the mind starts thinking about something. You know, like, you feel this incredible bliss. Oh, great. I wonder what I'm going to do tomorrow. I'm being facetious here, but just trying to keep you happy so you don't revolt on me. But do look at that, like look at change, because change is where you find liberation, rather than quality. We are obsessed with quality, we're obsessed with pleasant and unpleasant, but this very subtle, a different way of looking at your experiences through change, through the lens of change, really brings you back to your real home, where who you really are, where peace really lies. And that's a more arduous kind of task, isn't it? So I'll leave this for your reflection, just in case anyone rebels on me.
Pandamayang kamagataya sadhu karang dadamase.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.